This is Games as a Podcast.
All right, welcome to Games as a Podcast. I'm Chris, here with Ethan as usual. And today, among other things, we're going to cover Switch 2 impressions just a few weeks past launch.
Yeah, today we have a special guest. We have Chris Johnston, who we know as CJ. If you've heard Player One Podcast, you've heard his voice before. And he's somebody that I got my start podcasting with when the Switch 1 came out. I was lucky enough to be the fourth chair on his show, Player One Podcast, for a spell. And really look forward to talking Switch 2. CJ, welcome.
Thanks, Ethan and Chris. Great to be here on Games as a Podcast. I love podcasting. I love talking about video games. And it's great to be here with you guys.
Chocolate and peanut butter.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting how podcasting has exploded, but it was a huge thing way back more than a decade ago now in games. It's like one of the earliest categories where people just took to it. And you are now almost 1,000 episodes in on Player One Podcast. Oof. How many years is that?
Almost 20 at this point. We're coming up on 19 years. We started in October 2006. So a lot of system launches, a lot of games since that time. It's been a while. And as you say, like video games on podcasts, like was one of the early things that I listened to. One Up Yours, yep. The CAGcast, the Major Nelson Radio.
Giant Bomb.
Giant Bomb, yeah. Yeah, listened to all of those back in the day.
Great stuff. And Giant Bomb before that was Gerstmann on GameSpot, right?
Yep.
So long, long history. And you go back, though, way further than that when it comes to talking about games and editorials. So
be kind, Ethan.
Are you saying I'm old? Is this what this is about? You invite me on your podcast.
So say we all.
Well, to be fair, you did
wait,
start
I
in the...
I might be the youngest person here, maybe. Wait, Ethan, are you younger than me? I'm 48.
I'm 50, yep.
Am I the youngest?
You're the kid, you man. Yes.
Yes,
but you were the kid.
Still got it, baby.
You were the kid during the olden days of EGM when you started. How old That's were true. You when you started writing for that magazine?
I started writing for EGM in 1994, so I was 17 years old. I was still in high school, and it was my summer job over the summer in 1994 before my senior year. Yeah.
That's
it was a good time. Donkey Kong Country, Super.
Oh yeah.
Return of the Jedi was my first issue. We had like a lot of Killer Instinct at that time. Like,
oh yeah.
It was a great time to be in games journalism. I was a huge fan of all the video game magazines at the time, and I lived in the Chicago area. And EGM's headquarters just happened to be like one town over, which was perfect.
And now, Donkey Kong Country, if I remember correctly, Nintendo sent you like a big old box of Donkey Kong Country copies, right? And they all went to the editors, I'm sure. They did not.
They were passed out as favors at a birthday party for the editor-in-chief's kid. Yeah. Well, that was fun.
That was mighty
You get a Donkey
generous.
Kong, and you get a Donkey Kong.
Yeah, we didn't get any Donkey Kong Country. No.
So back actually when that game came out, you were at EGM. I was working at a mom-and-pop video store called Video City USA. And I had my own equivalent of kind of a zine there where I was printing for the people that came into the video store a monthly zine that let them know what games were coming out, and that was kind of my focus.
Did you create that?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, so we just kind of handwritten Xeroxed out, or
work? Typed out, not handwritten.
Typed out. Okay.
But yeah, and funny enough, the person who used to own the store, I've kept in touch with him to this day. He's like kind of a second dad to me. And last year, he sent me one of those zines in his Christmas card to me and said, "Remember this."
That's great.
Cool.
That's great. Awesome.
I was doing that, and of course, like I was so excited and inspired by EGM, which I would get every month. I'd go to Tower Records, pick up copies, and was really excited to learn that they, like CJ just said, were just about 30 minutes away from where I lived. And sometimes it's all about luck and timing, right? I happen to know a guy who was working for Time Warner Cable in their local news department, and he was a color copier, if I remember correctly, for the magazine. He was like doing multiple jobs. A guy named Scott Greinke, if you remember him, CJ?
Of course, and yeah.
I was talking games with him. He came over to my place. He saw an EGM poster for Metal Gear Solid on my wall, and he's like, oh yeah, I work for those guys. Do you want me to give you an introduction? So of course I said yes, and I was given a chance to interview for a previews editor position for EGM, I believe it was, which I did not get. John Dudlack got that role instead. Mm. But they were nice enough to say, but hey, we need freelancers. Do you want to write for us and just see where that goes? And I did that. And then after about 9 months, I finally got onto their new magazine, which was Game Now, which was the GamePro competitor. So for the younger audience. And that's where I ended up working closely with CJ. And I was on the same magazine as one of his co-hosts on Player One Podcast. And kind of the rest is history there. But that was a great time. And I only wish I had been there when the Dreamcast launched, because I remember the magazine that was tied to that launch. And CJ, can you talk to us a little bit about what that was like from an editorial perspective? Because we have talked, Chris and I, about what it's like from the Sega perspective.
Yeah, it was a really interesting time, right? Because Sega was going after this entertainment thing. Like, this was no longer a video game system that was a toy. This was a multimedia machine. And we were past the days of the PS1 and Saturn, and Dreamcast was like going to be the biggest 24 hours in entertainment history, was the big thing, right?
Bernie, right?
So $9.99. Mm-hmm. And all of us at the magazine were so super excited about Dreamcast, not only because it was a new Sega console, which we were already excited about, but also about the potential for online games and online gaming. And, you know, I had been playing Doom and Duke Nukem over the net for a while on my Mac, and thought, this is going to be great to have console games that we can play online. Like, I love that. So we were all super excited about it, and we did, you know, a lot of covers on Dreamcast and Dreamcast games back in the day.
So you had test kits, right?
We didn't have test kits. For Dreamcast, I believe we used a boot disk.
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
You didn't need test kits. It ran on Windows CE, so you just needed a disk that would boot in and then allow you to run the kind of burned copies of games.
Yeah. Yeah, boot disks to run GD-ROMs.
And so you'd get the games in review format, what, maybe a month before they'd officially come out?
Sometimes longer. Yeah, about a couple of weeks
before.
Depends
on the game.
Usually it depends on the game, yeah. The manufacturing cycle for a disc game is pretty short, so it depends, yeah, when it goes gold, and sometimes we got the gold version, sometimes we got, you know, a version or two back. Whether it was previewable or reviewable is kind of a question. If you were the previews or reviews editor, you always asked that to PR, and they would find out from the team whether the version that you had in the office was previewable or reviewable, and kind of go from there.
And so you made things very difficult for yourselves by having three-person review system, which was the kind of like calling card of EGM. It's something that I loved. I know Famitsu had done that years before, which is probably part of the inspiration I'm imagining.
But, it is, yeah.
How did you manage that? And did you talk to one another while you were reviewing it, or did you keep quiet, or were there any politics there?
Yeah, it's a great review system. I think we tried hard not to talk to each other while reviewing a game. We tried to come into something completely objectively and not discuss what we were going to give a game. And originally, EGM was 4 reviewers per game. And we luckily like toned that back to 3 at a certain point. I think there was a holiday season where there were just too many games coming out, and 4 people on each game was just unfeasible. So we changed it. And in fact, we changed it so that one person would be the big reviewer and write the majority of the text, and the other two would come in with other opinions. And I think that worked really, really well. But yeah, we wouldn't really talk to
each other. Supreme Court style?
Yeah, yeah. We wouldn't talk to each other. And then at the end, once you're done with your text and you have your scores, you say, hey, what did you give that game? And sometimes it was surprising and sometimes not. Star Fox Adventures, I gave a 4.5, I think.
Out of 10.
Out of 10. And I think James Milkey gave it an 8.5 or a 9. And I think history has borne out that I had the correct opinion on Star Fox Adventures.
And in those situations, do you average the scores, or was the lead reviewer have more weight? Or
no, they were all listed separately, so each reviewer got their own sort of score highlighted. There was no average or anything like that. It was sort of up to the reader to look at the three and then decide who they might agree with or disagree with.
The lead reviewer had more space, so it was
More space. Yes,
yeah, double or triple the length.
Yeah.
So I think I remember you giving a pretty damn high score to Sonic Adventure during Dreamcast launch.
Me? Did I review Sonic Adventure? I don't know if I did. If I did, I probably did give it a pretty high score. Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that sometimes it's hard to remember exactly what it you is. Reviewed? Unless it's something where, like Tomb Raider, I remember I gave it a D minus or something, and I got in some trouble from that from readers. But so the ones that really skew, you'll certainly remember. But yeah, it's hard 20 years on to remember exactly what you put to print.
Yeah, you know, let me look. Right? You know, we have this great thing that the EGM people did called the EGM Archive. And yes, I did. I give it a 9.5. Oh my gosh, I did review it. Wow.
9.5. Wow, that's 9.5. Like Mario 64 territory.
Is it? No, I really liked Sonic Adventure 1 at the time. Like 3D platformers, I think we're still kind of getting their feet, right?
Yeah.
So Sonic Adventure 1 did a lot of things that I think were very interesting for the genre and have been built upon in the years since Sonic Adventure. Going back, would I give it a 9.5 now? No. But at the time, it seemed like, yes, this was a bold new direction for Sonic. And even though, 3D platforming and going fast didn't really work so well in Sonic Adventure 1, but it was still a 9.5 at the time.
If you can remember, how did the Dreamcast launch square with your expectations? You know, sometimes the hype is real and sometimes it fizzles a bit. I'm just curious.
Mm. Yeah, I thought the hype was real on that one. Everyone on the magazine was so behind the Dreamcast, and it was in part because of Sonic, and Soul Calibur was also huge in the office. We would play Soul Calibur a lot. And
yeah,
so we really got behind the Dreamcast. I don't know that the market itself got behind the Dreamcast launch, but we were all hyped, and when launch day arrived, we were all picking up all the U.S. launch games, and we were deep into it.
Now, one of those launch games was Hydro Thunder, which you have a soft spot for, I know. There was a Hydro Thunder arcade machine, if I remember correctly, in the office at EGM, and didn't you become one of the world's best or something like that at that game?
Yeah, I'm still on the Twin Galaxies list for one of the tracks.
Wow.
I think I may have dropped out of the top 10 now, but yeah, I spent a lot of time on that Hydro Thunder machine. There was a CJ's butt groove kind of like wedged in the seat of that because it was like a sit-down cabinet, right? Luckily it wasn't stand-up, otherwise my legs would be in worse shape than they are now. But I spent a lot of time on that cabinet, and yeah, in fact, do hold some Twin Galaxies records on it.
So that was one of the things that was so cool, though, about the Dreamcast was not just Sega arcade games like Crazy Taxi, but Midway stuff, too. It was damn near arcade perfect, at least from my perspective. I'm not a world champ, pardon me. But, you know.
Yeah, you don't know the intricacies and nuances of the tracks of Hydro Thunder, Ethan. It was very close, and it certainly met my expectations for a home port of Hydro Thunder.
Well, NFL Blitz also. Like, I know that a lot of people were excited about NFL 2K because that was the big online one. But for me and my friends, a nearly arcade-perfect NFL Blitz at home was fantastic. We love that.
Yeah. I'm looking at the pull quote, by the way, in the Sonic Adventure review. Adventure is a masterpiece of a game, each inch finely detailed. This is what I said back in 1999. And I stand by that.
Yeah.
Back do you in still, 1999.
Do you stand by your Bubsy 3D quote on the back of that box?
Yeah. This is my secret shame is that I'm, well, not so secret shame, is that I'm quoted on the back, on the front of the Bubsy 3D box with a pull quote from a preview, which previews in EGM were supposed to be positive. What could I do? At least it's not my name on there. It's EGM said this. So, but I do have a frame. I have a framed copy of Bubsy 3D.
Yeah.
And signed by Bubsy.
Not signed by Bubsy.
Even though it's arguably the worst 3D platformer ever made, there still exists an expert on that mastered the game has YouTube videos. So there's something for everyone, I suppose.
Well, isn't that guy also a game developer and has made some pretty interesting games?
Oh, if that's the case, I didn't know it, but you've just added to the legend. Yeah.
I think that is the case, but... Yeah, and looking back at Sonic Adventure and even Bubsy 3D, to put them in the same shopping cart for a moment, they were early 3D platforms. People were still figuring out things like camera and how you interact with things in a 3D space. We had had 2D platforms, and we had characters like Bubsy and Sonic for many years before that had been perfected. But at the time these games came out, it was a Wild West, and nobody really knew how to make it work. Even like Tomb Raider 1, you look at the tank controls in Tomb Raider 1 and how dated that is now. But people didn't know how to do this stuff. They were kind of figuring it out. So even if those are not the best regarded now, I think back in the day, they were doing interesting things. Not Bubsy, more Sonic was doing interesting things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and to be fair, Sonic Adventure has been reissued multiple times. I am sure it will be reissued again. It's just one of those classics that people still enjoy playing.
It's true.
So going back to Dreamcast, I also wanted to mention that an oft-forgotten game that was a huge discussion point at launch was Ready to Rumble.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
That had so much personality, and I remember actually, outside of Sonic Adventure, that was probably the game I was most personally excited for. Next Generation was definitely really pumping that one up as well.
Yeah, that was a big one. Yeah.
So
exclusive, Dreamcast exclusive.
Yeah, so, that's right. That's right.
At the time, so many different games got ported to other hardware, but you have a third-party exclusive like Ready to Rumble, and it was big, yeah.
And we'll get to Switch 2 in a bit, but I do want to say, talking to my son, like you, CJ, we got multiple Switch 2s. I got one for myself, one for my son, one for my daughter. And we've all been having a lot of fun with Mario Kart World. But my son hasn't been playing anything else. And I asked why, and he's like, well, these are all old games. He said if there was even one new game that came out just for Switch 2, no matter what it is, I'd be excited about it. But even Cyberpunk, he's not excited about because that's many years old.
Yeah, I can see that.
He's played it?
He hasn't, but he likes the excitement of something that's new. So Donkey Kong Bonanza, he's all about that. He's super excited about that. But he also likes the idea of something
new. This is the same person that styles himself as a retro games enthusiast. So there's this window. If it's like 5 years or fewer old, he's not interested. But once it passes 10 years, it's a classic that he wants to play? Or what's the
rationale? There's definitely some truth to that, because the one thing he did kind of squirrel away from me was the Switch 2 GameCube controller. So he's been playing F-Zero and Soul Calibur 2, and yep, there you go,
Wind Waker.
And he's been loving that because, yeah, that's retro, so he's cool with that. And that sits in a different box. But
Ethan, is that weird for you now to hear, like, GameCube is retro and, oh, how retro this is?
Like, yes.
One is Dreamcast is retro. That hurts.
it does hurt.
It's
right?
True. It's true.
Yep.
It is true.
Which, by the way, I super hope that there is a Nintendo Switch Online channel for Dreamcast sometime. Wouldn't that make all the sense in the world if they're all the way up to GameCube and they have Genesis? Those games would fit like a glove. They'd probably be easier to port. They wouldn't be the kind of Saturn nightmare, right?
Hmm. They'd be 100% easier to port than Saturn.
Yes. Let me tell you what I'm looking forward to on the GameCube NSO app. Phantasy Star Online Episode 1 and 2 because that had a split screen mode on the GameCube. It was the only platform to have that. So you could actually, because NSO games that are multiplayer, you can play those online together. So you could potentially then play online PSO once again with three friends. And I think that would be awesome because I was such a huge fan of that game.
Is this a hope or is it announced?
This is a hope. This did not get announced yet, but I am like, fingers crossed, please. Here's my effigy of Yuji Naka.
If Nintendo took on the moderation aspect, maybe Sega would let it happen, but I can't imagine Nintendo wanting to do that, and I cannot imagine Sega saying, yeah, sure, let's launch an online game and deal with all the resultant headaches that that happen when you do that.
Come on. Do it. Do it, Sega. Come on.
I speak this from personal experience because I was there when we launched it, and it was a great game. We had a small team of moderators, and it was a lot of work to stay on top of the the constant barrage of griefers and, well, yeah.
But just because it would
online
be
community.
Ultimately on NSO, this would be a local game. I'm not saying reopen the servers. I'm saying
I see.
The local multiplayer aspect of it would be fun.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, I'd say if anything, we're more likely to see Phantasy Star Online 2 or maybe 3 if that becomes a thing. Because they probably want that Nintendo audience to play those games, right?
They're never going to make that. I wish they would, but they're never going to.
It is an interesting thing with Switch 2, where unlike phones and unlike consoles, you cannot assume that players are going to be online. And in fact, probably half the time they're not, because there's no 5G connection. So I think that there are some great multiplayer experiences, obviously Mario Kart World being among them. But even there, that game is very much made to be deeply enjoyed single player or locally, without a online connection. I think that's really a kind of unspoken core differentiation between that and the current consoles in terms of what type of software you get. Because if you look at all the stuff that is coming back, it's all like single player stuff that's much friendlier for gaming on the go. In fact, Hitman World of Assassins has the same setup as the Xbox and PlayStation versions, where you're supposed to kind of always be online to get your bonuses and to have your account get updated when you unlock things. And it's super unwieldy and unpleasant because about half the time I'm not connected to anything, right? Because I'm at a coffee shop and I don't want to bother connecting. And that's just very different. So that just makes it easier to play something like Yakuza 0 or Cyberpunk.
Sure. Yeah. I think Nintendo is generally been a laggard when it comes to online activities. They've just not cared to keep abreast with the latest and greatest, technologically speaking. And maybe it's because they can't. They have those amazing single-player experiences. That said, it's a bit disconcerting that the offering is still so lackluster. I think there's kind of this universe of best practices that exist in everywhere else except for Nintendo Land. Achievements, just being able, making it easy for two people who are playing together to kind of register that they're playing together. So I know maybe we can segue into Switch 2, but you know, my wife is frustrated when we play Mario Kart together that she can't log in as herself. It's like my other account or controller tied to my other account. And I'm guessing it's something to do with how they deal with game ownership on the platform. But I feel like in this day and age, you got to have a more elegant profile solution. And it kind of ties into this kind of lack of achievements.
Yeah,
there's this lack of an overarching system that kind of envelops the world, and I feel like it's kind of a no-brainer, almost basic ante for online gameplay these days. I do appreciate the unlocks and the tracking they have in Mario Kart World, for example, unlocking stickers and cars, and I just don't know why they wouldn't extend that outside the game world, so to speak.
Yeah, well, every so often, like, games Nintendo makes support some of these things. Like, I don't know if you played Mario Party Superstars or Jamboree, but they allow guest players, if you're playing on a main profile, they allow guest players to select a profile on your system that they are the account owner or whatever. Like, so they can log in as themselves in Mario Party and, like, unlock progression and things
okay.
for their own game.
So they do it.
They do it in that, but for some reason, maybe not in Mario Kart World, and I don't really quite understand why that is the case. And if you remember, like, ARMS back on the Switch 1, when that launched, like, the lobby system that they had, I thought was great, where you can get a party of, like, 12 players, and it just kind of, like, matches everybody up and, like, continues everybody's playing everybody else, and you can watch or practice and all this stuff. And they've, in my opinion anyway, they have not done a lobby system as good as ARMS since that point. Although I do like Mario Kart World is all right in that respect, but it could be so much better. And Zelda, I don't know if you played the Breath of the Wild or Tears of the Kingdom Switch 2 editions, but they have added achievements, quote unquote, in their Zelda Notes app, where you can, like, it looks at your save and then gives you a certain amount of medals. You don't get anything for that, but you got to look at your progression.
Satisfaction of a job well done.
Exactly. Exactly. I was never really like, well, first of all, when the 360 introduced achievements, I was big into it. I was
Oh, everyone was. Yeah. Yep.
And PS3, when they introduced trophies, same deal. Now that I'm older and wiser, I have decided to let go of my FOMO in terms of achievements, and just I no longer really worry about that. But it is also good for just like looking your own progression through a game or a friend's progression through a game. Like if I want to know how far my friend Phil is or Ethan is in Yakuza 0, I can't see that on the Switch. And so that, to me anyway, like achievements is maybe less important of let me see how far you are compared to myself sort of thing.
I think they serve slightly different use cases depending on the type of player you are. I was never a completionist, but it's still nice to get kind of that Scooby snack for hitting a certain thing. And then, like you said, comparing yourself against other your friends and whatnot. Or just even gauging where you are in the game in terms of, oh, well, maybe I should put some more hours in and get over the 50% mark or something like that.
That's true.
Frankly, sometimes I'm surprised that companies allow some of that information to be presented. An example is I finished Assassin's Creed Shadows after about 100 hours of play, and that was a lot of stuffing in that game. There was a lot of hamburger helper in there to make that last as long as it did. But I unlocked the trophy for finishing the game, and it said that I was one of like 11% of people to do it. And does Ubisoft really want people to know that only 11% of people are finishing their massive game of 2024? I'm shocked that they allow that information to go out.
I don't think they care. I think once they have your $60-$70, they're fine. And I honestly, 10% probably feels about right for a game that size. There's plenty. So obviously, the vast majority of people don't finish those games.
Yeah.
Who has the time?
Although you look at games like Spider-Man on PlayStation, and that percentage is a lot higher. But you're right.
Like, same amount of hours?
It probably
you
isn't.
You could actually. You could, but not the critical path.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because I remember Tim Schafer kind of famously saying at one point that his habits changed with Xbox 360, where it was no longer that he was saying, I'm going to play Gears of War tonight, or I'm going to play Halo 3 tonight. It was, I'm going to play Xbox tonight. And the reason was that he'd just drop into that ecosystem, and he'd check the achievements, and he'd kind of think through which game he wanted to play, maybe an Xbox Live Arcade game, maybe something bigger. But the habit was Xbox, not the specific game.
Do you do that with Switch 2, since we're on...
That's like, a great question.
The first 2 weeks of Switch 2, have you found yourself being like, I want to pick up this console and look and see what I've got on it, and maybe I'll try this or that? That's the way I've been playing.
Yes, and it's interesting looked at from that perspective, because me too, and I didn't know if it would this time, because with Switch 2 launching... I'm now in a position where I have two PlayStation 5s. I have the PS5 downstairs, the PS5 Pro upstairs, and the PS Portal, just in case one of those two screens are not available to me, right? So I'm not in a position where I don't have access to a PS5, which was my pain point with PS4 when the Switch 1 came out. Like, I had one PS4, it was tied to my TV, and if my wife was still watching an episode of West Wing or something, I was stuck. I couldn't play anything. I had to wait till everyone went to bed. So Switch 1 was kind of revelatory in that I could play whenever I wanted. But now I can play PS5 whenever I want. I also have a Steam Deck. I have a ROG Ally. And so I just wondered, like, would the Switch 2 be nearly as meaningful to me as the Switch 1 was? And the answer, almost surprisingly, is yes, absolutely, because it turns on right away. Three button presses and I'm in. It picks up where I left off. The battery length is not fantastic, but I'll tell you, it's way better than ROG Ally, where you have to like pretty much set it up next to a wall that has an outlet to be able to play. Unlike Steam, it beautifully pops up onto the big TV when that is available. That is still a magic trick that no other company has done nearly as well. And so, yeah, it has once again become my favorite place to play, and I haven't touched anything else since I got my Switch 2, and I think that's likely to continue.
And do you find yourself playing your back catalog to see how well they run compared to Switch 1, or what's the mix?
Yes, definitely, especially the games that have specific patches for it.
Yep.
So I've been doing a lot of experimenting. As far as that's concerned, it has saved some games. So I didn't even bother playing Pokemon Violet and Scarlet because it ran like ass. My kids somehow were able to push through it because they're super fans, but I just couldn't do it. Now I'm starting to play and really enjoying it. Same thing with Zelda Echoes of Wisdom. That thing was rough on Switch 1, and now it's flawless. And the art style is just so beautiful. So when it's that art style combined with 60 frames a second, it's just wonderful. And you only got half that picture on Switch 1, unfortunately. So I've been playing pretty deeply into that. And some games just from brute force are running better. So Bayonetta 3 does not have a patch, but now it's roughly 60 frames a second. Surprisingly, Batman Arkham Knight, which is one of the worst performing games on the machine. It was a joke when it came out as a feature of the Arkham trilogy. Now it crashes a lot, but it actually runs closer to 60 frames a second, which is really a huge improvement. So the textures are still terrible, but like it's actually playable now. And for me, it's fun to find those like hidden like gems where things run a little better. I don't know if you've been digging in there.
Quick question. So how do you think those games make it through standards? If it was just utter shite at launch on the Switch, how did Nintendo greenlight it?
I mean, have you looked at some of the digital games that are available on the eShop? It's like that Nintendo seal of approval has gone away a long time ago. There's so much shovelware and crap on the Switch. It's kind of shocking.
Well, it's not just Switch. If you check the PlayStation Store, that's also...
Or Steam or...
Steam to a lesser extent.
I guess Steam's a little more diligent about pruning stuff that... and they
about
actually
surfacing
review,
that
review
stuff.
Things. Yeah. Yeah.
They don't really review content on Steam, but for some reason their algorithms just tend to bubble up the games that people are actually playing and caring about and liking. So
yeah,
it's a benefit there. But yeah, almost every console digital store has the same issue. Not quite as bad as the eShop, because the eShop is just a wasteland of so many like editions of AAA Clock and hentai girls dating.
Yeah, I've heard about the hentai stuff. Also, there is an update to the store with the Switch 2, though. I wonder if that will have a meaningful impact on the shovelware or maybe not presenting it so much front and center.
They've tried. They've moved recent releases down towards the bottom, which I think will make that a little less viewed. And then also they've bubbled up recent releases that are more curated editorially to the top of that list, so that'll help even more. So I'm fingers crossed hoping that this will it's not going to spell the end of the AI slop that gets uploaded.
It's a little better, which is good, and slightly. I think that kind of calls back to my previous point about Nintendo kind of being a little behind the times in terms of online functionality, and recommendation algorithms would be a part of that.
Yeah.
So it doesn't surprise me that it's that way. It's just unfortunate.
I think they've done a great job with the redesign of the eShop. I think
it's fast.
So far, I really like it. It's fast. It's got space for your wish list items. It tells you how many items are on sale at any particular time when you load it up, which I think is fantastic. Like, it's easier to find the games you should be playing or want to play, which should be their goal, so I'm down with it.
Well, and the full backwards compatibility is something that's super, super important. I know some people have said, this just feels like a Switch 1.5, but it's like, hey, I want to have access to all of those older games, because when Switch 1 came out, you can't carry over the Wii U games. In fact, you were expected to just flat out buy those again.
It's true.
So it's nice that we're not just being repackaged those Switch 1 games as Switch 2 games at full price.
Well, for me, like I loaded up Splatoon 3 when they updated that.
Yep.
And that runs beautifully and looks great, of course. And then I've oddly been playing a lot of Tears of the Kingdom with the Switch 2 upgrade because I never finished that game and I sort of dropped off it. But even though I liked it, I dropped off of it for some unknown reason. Some other game probably came out, but I'm really liking it on Switch 2. Like, I'm really... So, first of all, they allowed...
Is it sticking more? You just feel more compelled to play it?
Yes.
Awesome. Yes.
Part of it is they added a second save slot. So, here's what I did. I, like, loaded up the second save slot, started a new game, went through the tutorial, like, the plateau area, then Tears of the Kingdom, got reacquainted with everything. Then I loaded up my old save, which I hadn't touched since 2023, and... started playing. And the Zelda Notes feature that's in the Switch 2 app, I know it's like, whatever, second screen stuff, this is kind of boring, but I've actually been using the GPS feature in that quite a lot.
Oh, yeah.
You can bring it up and it's like, you can have it show you only shrines and things that you haven't discovered, and then hit a button to give you like voice GPS directions to the shrine. And I've been doing that and it's great. I've like found some shrines that I didn't do before and I'm enjoying that. And there's like a daily bonus thing that you can kind of like, it's sort of a slot machine game that gives you a meal benefit or whatever. So I've been doing that and I'm actually really enjoying it on the Switch too. And great. Part of it is that 60 frames a second 4K graphics. I mean, it looks beautiful now, whereas I think it was pushing the Switch quite a bit on release. So
well, and really, like Wind Waker, it has a kind of timeless art style. It's still highly stylized, so it looks good today. If you look at something like Twilight Princess, that was trying to be realistic and now looks kind of muddy, it just doesn't hold up as well as those titles do. But yeah, I think that if they released a new Zelda game in exactly that style and it simply looked exactly the same as the other two, people would be more than happy and wouldn't be like, oh, this looks old. It ages well. So speaking of aging well, I've been playing a lot of Yakuza 0. And that has been definitely my kind of main game after I got my fill of Mario Kart World. I'll still go back to Mario Kart World and play things, but after I get the gold rewards on the 150cc class, I kind of feel like I've beaten it, right? So on to Yakuza. And what I've realized about that game as I've been playing it, and I'm playing on normal, and CJ, I know you said you went to easy. I think that you'd be just as fine with normal because it's not designed to be hard. In fact, the fighting is pretty repetitive because that's not the focus of the game at all. It's really a visual novel. That's what it is. And so you're going from place to place and there are these very long story beats, but it knows how to compel you. And even the action gameplay is tied to some type of narrative beat, like saving a blind woman as you're trying to escort her. And you have like really strong feelings about her having to be safe and she's so vulnerable. And so you have those kinds of ties into the gameplay that makes it more compelling. It's not just constantly beating up street thugs, right? And I find myself just really getting invested and involved in the characters, especially Goro Majima, who I've played Yakuza 0 before. I never got to the point where he unlocks in the game. And the way he's introduced in this is so cool. It's like, and again, ties again to this idea that the gameplay focuses on the narrative beats where he says he's the owner of like basically a hostess club and there's somebody who's being really obnoxious and wants to pick a fight with him, and he says that the customer is always king in his hostess bar, so he will not throw a punch, and so you have to just kind of dodge and exhaust the other guy while being very deferential to this obnoxious customer. And that's the fighting style you have to use, and it's just super cool. You have to break dance at another point where it ties to the story. And so the gameplay is totally secondary, but the story is up front and it's compelling like a novel. And so like Steins Gate or like any really good visual novel, that's what's been pulling me into that game and getting me to turn it on every night.
Yeah, I'm right there with you on Yakuza 0. Like, I think it's great. I had attempted to play it a couple of times before, and like you said, I never got to the point of introducing Goro Majima either. But I am past that point now on Switch 2, and I am really loving it. I am playing on easy because, not because I'm worried about it being too difficult. I never actually want it to get to that point where it's I never want to run into any, like, oh, I forgot to put points into the skill tree and didn't level up enough, and that's why I lost this fight to this boss. Like, I never want to... I feel like if I have to redo a fight or redo too much of the game, I'll just drop it and not come back. So
you're there for the narrative, right? You want to enjoy the
I'm there for the narrative. So. Yeah, and I got into the Yakuza series with Like a Dragon, Yakuza 7. So that was the turn-based thing where, yeah, I didn't have to worry about the sort of twitch mechanic of button combos and all that. So I much prefer that style. So if I don't have to do any of that, I'm good with that.
Yep.
Well, and then enjoying it. I'm playing it in English because the English dub is new for Yakuza 0. Mm. So I am really enjoying it.
Yeah, I have to admit,
as Majima is very good, and everyone in the cast is great. So
I did admittedly switch right to Japanese about 10 minutes into the English dub, just because, like, I've always found that the drama feels better when it's in Japanese, and it may be terrible in Japanese, I have no way of knowing, you know, but it's subtitled, so it's like I felt like Shenmue felt noble and really dramatic and exciting when it was the subbed version. The dub version, like, left me cold, and that's where people were joking about the, have you found any sailors? That type of, like, thing, so...
Yeah, I find with Switch anyway, like, I am playing it in handheld sometimes, like, before bed or whatever, and I don't want to have to, like, focus on the screen or, like, read a lot.
Yep.
So I'm using the dub for that reason. Yeah.
So that makes sense. Speaking of Sega games on Switch 2, I am at the final boss now in Sonic Shadows Generations. And this is a game that I just love. It came out, of course, in, I think, 2011 on Xbox 360, so it's an old game, but it runs so much better on the Switch 2 than Switch 1. I wish it had an upgrade path. It doesn't, and that's really frustrating because I actually own it on Switch 1. So if I could have paid $10 to get an upgrade, that would have been a nice feature. But that said, 30 to 60 makes a huge difference in a game like that. And the resolution also, when you're talking about these bright, beautiful environments. Now, it doesn't run at that level in the shadow sequences. That goes to either performance or quality. And so I've done performance, which is like probably about 45 frames per second, and still runs smoothly enough. But the original Sonic Generations content is just perfect on Switch 2 and was not on Switch 1. So it was worth it playing through all over again just to enjoy it at that kind of peak performance level. And that is, sure, that is one of those games also that doesn't feel dated. That continues to surprise me, where games from like 2005 up to me still feel contemporary. So when Gears of War comes out, if that rumor is true, or Halo 2 on the Switch 2, I think those will still feel pretty contemporary. They'll feel pretty modern.
Yeah, I think, you know, Switch 2 isn't trying to push the most polygons or be the most graphically sizzling console. So it'll be interesting a couple of years from now when the next generation of consoles come out, what the compromises are going to have to be made to get them on the Switch 2, which similar to the challenges they had with Switch 1. So I think now is a great time to be enjoying the content, because I think in a 2 years' time, you'll definitely be going back to your PS6 to play the latest and greatest that are pushing the visual blockbusters.
Yeah, well, especially with something like GTA 6 when that comes out, that obviously will never, ever come to Switch 2. So there's...
Oh, that's coming out.
Yeah. Not this year, but
eventually.
Yeah. Eventually.
You think that'll come out on Switch 2?
No.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
That would be impressive.
I'd play GTA 5 again. That would probably fit just fine. And there's rumors of Red Dead Redemption 2 coming.
Yeah.
Which is one of those other games I never actually finished, so.
Yeah, I didn't finish that either. I loved riding my horse around. Those open world ones I almost rarely finish. I'll put in 60 hours, but won't get close to finishing it just because I get ooh, there's a shiny thing over there. Let me ride over and see what's going on. Oh, it's a bear. Run away.
Yep.
Sometimes that's more fun than actually like finishing a game like that, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. I never finished Cyberpunk. I played it on Stadia, which was by far the best platform to play it on at launch. And I got all the way to the final boss, and I didn't finish it because I wanted to go back and fill in some other bits. And then, you know, Stadia died, and with that, my save. But maybe someday I'll go back and play it again.
Well, the mouse controls on Cyberpunk's pretty great, actually.
I did not know it had mouse controls.
Yeah.
On Switch 2, really? Uh-huh. Okay. Uh-huh. Cool.
Yeah.
I haven't actually tried the mouse controls thing. I should check it out.
Yeah, the only reason I haven't used it more is simply because usually if I'm playing off TV, I want to hold it. And if I'm playing it on TV, I want to use my Pro Controller. So yeah, that right. kind of negates the easy use case of that. But I have been playing Rune Factory 5, which is kind of a cozy game with light battle that you're setting up a farm. And if you click the L button, it goes to mouse mode and it goes top down, and you can just use the mouse to click every single little plot that you have to farm. And it's super convenient mm-hmm. and easy to do, and it knows when you're holding it down for mouse mode versus holding it sideways for regular play. And you have all the buttons. The one thing that takes a little getting used to is like where to put your hand so that you can both press buttons on it and move it. And it's a little awkward. It doesn't feel like a mouse, of course, but the responsiveness is pretty great. And when you're playing something like Cyberpunk, just the aiming is really joy, because I'm so used to just regular kind of subtle auto aim. And that's fine. It does that too. You can also use the motion control the gyro to slightly, like when you're zoomed in, right, move it so that you can get your headshots, and that feels really good too. That's a nice option, but just doing mouse controls on a console is wonderful.
Yeah, interesting. I did not know that Cyberpunk supported mouse control. That's cool.
Yeah. And
speaking of controllers, I'm super impressed with the Pro Controller for the Switch 2.
Yeah.
It is like butter. Great build quality. So smooth. I'm loving it as a controller. Just kudos to Nintendo, because it's a beautiful piece of hardware.
The finish feels so good in the hand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, it really does. I like the matte plastic that they're using just throughout their Switch 2 stuff. The console itself and the Pro Controller. Yeah, just feel really nice.
No fingerprints.
Yeah, the controller, the console too feels really great, well built. The Joy-Cons fit so well in there, and the mechanism to unseat them, super nice. It's got enough heft to feel quality, and it just feels very well put together, well built.
Yeah, I am curious, like for the Switch 1, I ended up using the Hori Split Pad Pro, which sort of gives you a more ergonomic pad on the side of the Switch, and I loved that. And now going back to Switch 2, it's like, oh, my fingers are kind of crampy.
Yeah, though the Hori one didn't have rumble or a gyro either.
No rumble or gyro in the Hori Split Pad, but you know what? Comfort won out.
Yeah.
Well, now using that more.
Speaking of that, so CJ, we come from a different place getting the Switch 2 than Chris does, because Chris didn't own a Switch 1. So this is his first time at this. But
all right.
Chris, you have had a Steam Deck. So
yes.
This is a completely unique perspective. Does this replace your Steam Deck, sit next to it? Are you still preferring Steam Deck? Are you docking the Switch 2 at all, or just playing it handheld like you do Steam Deck? How does that work for you?
Yeah, I have not touched my Steam Deck since the Switch 2 has entered the household. And I'm fine with that. I don't think it will completely replace it, but I think it will definitely be my daily driver for the foreseeable future. It's sitting primarily docked mode right now, but I am going on vacation in a couple weeks, and I'm looking forward to bringing it with me and enjoying the gaming on the go. So it's been great. Steam Deck, I've said it before, it is a phenomenal piece of hardware. It's so great, so customizable. I love the fact that I can chip away at my Steam library on the couch, because as I said before, after spending, you know, 10 hours a day at my desk, it's sometimes hard to go, oh, I'm going to spend a couple more hours here, fire up some games on my Steam library. So I really love that the deck allows me to work through the library that will never fully go away. But there's a lot of stuff to catch up on the Switch. I've played a lot of Switch games because I borrowed a friend's Switch to check out Zeldas and Mario and whatnot. But now that it's in home 24/7, I'm definitely looking forward to taking a greatest hits tour, and it's been a joy so far.
That's great. And again, it does come with some challenges, like you don't get those Steam summer sales. If anything, true, you're being asked to spend premium prices for a lot of these games. So I remember when I got Steam Deck, I bought Yakuza specifically for that as well, and that was like $15 or something on a sale, whereas it's 60 yeah. bucks on the Switch 2. That being said, it's an interesting comparison for me, because when I tried to play Yakuza on the Steam Deck, it ran just fine until I popped it onto the big screen TV, and then for whatever reason, I had to completely change the settings to make it run properly. And I eventually was able to figure it out, but it was a level of tinkering that I just don't like dealing with. And
yeah, it's definitely not a, it's not a, yeah, it's not so easy. But if you like tinkering, I kind of like tinkering, so it's kind of fun for me to figure out how to squeeze performance out of games.
Yeah, I can see that. I guess where it really frustrates me, though, is like Cyberpunk, another example. I was very excited to play that on my Steam Deck when I first got it. And during one of these kind of investigation sequences, that's the type of thing that's fun to play once, but you definitely don't want to do it twice. The game crashed on me twice on Steam Deck in that part, and that was enough for me to say, I'm sure there's a solution. There's some optimal thing I can find on Reddit to get me through this with the settings just so, but I don't want to deal with that. And so, again, with the Switch, you just seamlessly get through that sequence because every machine is optimized specifically for that.
Yep, for sure.
The other thing also is that Nintendo, again, always understands that kind of ritual of wanting to be able to play on the big screen in your living room. And the Steam Deck, like, you can technically do it, but it's not been optimized very well to do that. And so same thing with the ROG Ally. I actually went so far as for the ROG Ally to buy their 3080-based dock that would allow you to connect it, and it then has a powerful GPU. I think I put it, even though it cost me about $1,000.
So you bought you bought a PC for your handheld PC.
Right. And I think I used it a total of 3 hours or something, because I was playing Uncharted, and it's like, oh, this is cool. Crash. All right, let's get a little further. Crash. It's like, I just don't want to deal with that, right? So I still use my ROG Ally, but almost exclusively as my Xbox version of a PS Portal. So I'll use it to stream my Xbox games, and that's about it. And those machines also, ROG Ally in particular, like you play something like God of War on it or something that's requires a lot of power, and you'll get 45 minutes and it's dead. And again, the Switch is not going to give you a full plane ride from Chicago to LA necessarily, but it will give you a nice 2.5 hours of even Cyberpunk, which I appreciate.
Yeah, and thankfully planes have a place to plug in now usually too, yes. So... yeah, usually you're okay with that. Yeah, I played Mario Kart World on my flight from LA back to Seattle and didn't drain the battery the entire time. And I also bounced over to Yakuza 0 at the same on the same trip. So, and it was very nice. Very nice. And I love the screen, by the way. Like, I know there's been a lot of comments about how the screen's not good, and okay, it's not an OLED screen. The Steam Deck OLED is a very pretty screen, and that is maybe like the top end of things. But I think the screen on the Switch 2 is good enough. Like it is not.
It does the job.
It does the job. I don't think it's bad. I had a Switch OLED before this, and that, of course, was also very vibrant. But I think this is pretty close. Like, unless if I have them side by side, I can tell the difference. But if I don't, then I still really like the Switch 2 screen. I think it's good. And the Switch 2 overall just feels like an upgraded Switch. Feels like a better Switch, and that's what I wanted. Exactly. I've wanted that for like 4 years at least, and now we have it, and I'm happy about that. The one thing that hasn't been such a great experience is the extended memory. So I bought a memory card for my Switch 2. The 256 gig is the one that's like most available, and I had a 1 terabyte card on my Switch 1. So when I did my system transfer, it started downloading everything that was on my Switch One, which is, you know, 1 terabyte full of games. And obviously the 256 couldn't handle it. So I am going to have to clean the fridge now, I guess, on Switch 2. And that'll be fine until 1 terabyte cards get around the $100 mark. Then I'll upgrade to that.
Yeah, I did. I did get the 1 terabyte card myself when
You're
I was
maniac.
At Games.
Maniac. Yes.
He is.
When I
the prices are only going to go down on that. I mean, I get it because I would have loved to do that launch too, but a little too pricey at the outset.
It's a it's such a specialized format. You can get 1 terabyte storage for so cheap now, but so it feels really bad to have to shell out such a premium for this specialized little.
Also, why did they do that? Card. Why did they make it this version of the SD card?
Yeah, exactly.
Like
exactly.
I don't quite understand why, but
You know, Nintendo's always loved their specialized formats. So.
Well, every now and again, like Nintendo, they're historically they use old technology and make something new out of it. That's like their philosophy, going back to like Gunpei Yokoi. But the Switch used USB-C at a time when not a whole lot of devices were using USB-C, and
not even Apple.
Through the life of the Switch, I was very happy that they made that decision because other devices like caught up, and then all of a sudden I had more USB-C things to plug in, and the Switch kind of slotted into that really nicely. So happy about that. And then now they're picking this memory format that nobody else uses.
Yeah.
It's like, oh no. But like, so sometimes they make those decisions which at launch, it's like, why did they do this? I don't have adapters for this, or I don't have the storage is too expensive. Hopefully, fingers crossed that that will come down as we get further on into the Switch life. And there's some benefit in terms of like the speed of data transfer between that card and the Switch 2 itself.
Yeah, I think with the fantastic launch that they've had, more parties are going to be interested in supporting it. So I think you will see more options out there, and as a result, the prices should get better.
Yeah.
So as you're setting up the machine, I wonder how many people who have a Switch 1 are just going to take the dock out, keep the cords in, and swap in the new dock. Which would be a mistake, of course, because it's a different HDMI cable and it's a different power cable. It's 60 hertz now. So it's like, I just wonder, like, how many people are going to have significantly reduced performance just because they don't realize that they look the same and they think they're just saving a quick step in setup by just using the same cords. I, in fact, even got stuck where I unplugged both HDMI cables and I couldn't remember which one was the Switch 2 one and which was the Switch 1. And I actually used ChatGPT to take a picture of the two to say, which one is it? And it helped me. You know, it's not, it doesn't like say Switch 2 on one of those cords. It's not obvious.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think even in the instructions, they say not to do that, like not to use your Switch 1 stuff. And had I not read that on the internet, I probably would have just swapped them out.
Right. Well, I had my daughter's friend was over. She had a Switch 1, and she wanted to show my daughter something, and she wanted to put the Switch 1 into the Switch 2 dock, which I don't think you can do. We didn't try it. I said that probably isn't something we should try, but do you know anything about that, either of you?
No, I have no idea. That would be awesome.
No, but go ahead. Take one for the team and let us know.
That's like asking someone to taste a Switch 2 cartridge. I think I'll pass.
Exactly. I mean, it brings up a good question as well. Like, what are you doing with your Switch 1 now that you have a Switch 2? Are you keeping it?
I'm keeping it, yeah.
Are you going to play it?
Are you going to keep all of them?
Have you turned it on since you bought the Switch 2?
Nope.
Exactly. You're shaking your head, Ethan. This is an audio podcast. No, you have not.
That's right. Yeah,
I haven't either.
Yeah, exactly. I keep all my stuff now because there was this window of time where I went over to that classic game store, 4J's, and brought all of my stuff, everything I had from the NES era up, and just traded it all in for an HDTV, which at the time was very expensive. And boy, do I wish I had not done that, because I've been slowly rebuying all that stuff over time at a ridiculous markup now. So I don't want to do that again.
Yeah, but how many household Switches do you have?
Four.
So do you think you need all four?
I guess not. I guess I just I've fallen out of the habit of trading stuff in is really the thing.
Yeah, I think Switch 1, more than any other console previously, I feel like trading it in or selling it off, like I kind of don't need it anymore.
Yep.
And I'm wondering why I'm keeping it. And to think that, oh, I'm keeping it because I collect video games, I don't really anymore. And all my library is digital on everything. I've been all digital since 2013 and haven't missed it. And so why am I keeping the Switch 1? I don't know.
So I did want to talk for just a second about game keys, because that's caused quite a ruckus. And you might be surprised to hear that while I don't love it, I actually really appreciate that they're super transparent about it. So they're going to do it anyway. And if you look at like Modern Warfare 2, we just had an episode last week where we were talking about physical versus digital. And one of the topics that came up was Modern Warfare 2 and the fact that it just basically had an unlock file. It was a game key. There was no game on that disc. But they didn't say anything about that. So that was only discovered when someone actually looked at the files on the disc and reported it on Reddit. Here, Nintendo's at least saying that's what it is. And it still allows you to trade your games in if you so desire. You can loan them to friends if you want to. The onus is just on your friends then to download the whole game, which they'd have to do a patch anyway. I don't like it from a preservation standpoint, because once those games are off the servers, those game keys are useless. And so games like Cyberpunk or Mario Kart that are on the actual cartridge are more valuable to me, because I'll be able to play those well after the system is no longer being serviced. But still, what are your thoughts about game keys? Pro, con, indifferent?
I am pro game key, and here's why. Cheaper for third-party manufacturers to produce and have a physical product on shelves. And as you say, so many modern games now are patched, and you have to have the patch to have the best experience. And also, hey, you can trade it back in. And it's a digital game. It's not a key code in a box that you can't sell back. You can actually sell this back. Like, and I feel like a lot of consumers nowadays do that. Either trade with friends or sell them back to other people or GameStop. And I think it's a better solution for people who still want to be able to do that, but also have the convenience of digital from, well, the third party side, I guess, in terms of cost and everything else.
Yeah. Chris, what do you think?
You know what I think. I think it's great. Less plastic out there. It's good. Ethan, I bought my first physical game in a long time. I bought a Breath of the Wild Switch 2 version.
Nice.
And it's a whole lot of packaging for this little memory card that's, you know, a centimeter by a centimeter and a half. And I don't see – I understand the collection aspect and keeping a library. You know, I like books, whatnot. But it just does not seem particularly practical or even needed in today's day and age. And this, the key, the digital key, I think is kind of the best of both worlds. You kind of have this aspect of ownership, and you have this tangible digital thing that you can, that has value, that persists, so you can trade or sell back, et cetera. So
yep.
It's a win-win.
Well, I think grandma appreciates it too, because when the kids ask for a new game, it's always nice to have something to actually physically unwrap under the tree.
I think that's absolutely true, yeah. Although, like, the experience of buying games in 2025 versus the experience of buying games in 2005, like, entirely different. I was at Target the other day, and I was like, well, maybe I want to get the Switch 2 camera. And I had to find somebody to help me. And when I found someone, they were like, well, I'm not the person with the key to that, so I'll have to get it somebody else. I stood around and ended up, nobody came by to help, so I left.
Yep.
It's like even peripherals now are locked away on the shelf, and like you can't pick up a game box and bring it to the front, no matter if you're shopping at Best Buy or Target or wherever. Like, experience of retail buying, physical buying, is just so different. And to me, it doesn't, it's not good. So I don't feel good about buying physical anyway. I feel better about just buying digital. I have Donkey Kong Bonanza pre-ordered. It'll preload on the Switch a week before. It'll be ready to play at 9 p.m. on release day. Like, that's a much better experience than going to Target and hoping that somebody comes by to help me to get this game out of the out of the case.
So my feeling is, if it is on the actual cartridge, I'm always going to prioritize getting that, like Donkey Kong and Cyberpunk and Mario. Just because, again, I am a collector of retro games, so I think that those will be a lot more valuable 20 years from now.
I think what broke me about physical games is that, well, I've said this on the on Player One podcast before, but my storage unit was burgled in 2022, so I lost my entire physical games collection and all of those things, and so that has now made me like really care about digital because those couldn't get taken from me, right? Like, so all the games that I owned before are now gone, and so I have a different way of looking at it. Like, I no longer care about collecting games and stuff. Yeah. Like, that's no longer a thing for me, but I want to support the content and play the content, and now I can go back. I love the NSO classic stuff that Nintendo's doing, because I'm getting a lot of those games that I lost, like Wind Waker on GameCube. I can play that again. I wasn't able to a few years ago, so.
Yep.
That is nice.
Yeah.
Was there a little, once you got over the initial trauma, was there a little catharsis in being freed from all that physical stuff?
Yes, there was. It took me a year or two to get over it, because it's just left like a huge void in myself. And like Ethan knows, like, I've been in the games industry for 30 years at this point, and it accrued a lot of physical games and memorabilia and stuff that was suddenly all gone. And like, to feel that loss, it was,
it's rough.
And I felt like it was a part of me as well, because, you know, my career in games, like, all of that was tied up in physical things and stuff. Like, and suddenly having that gone, it felt terrible. And it was a lot of working through it with a therapist, like, to deal with it. But then, yes, also feeling catharsis, like, okay, now I don't have that. I don't need a separate storage area for any of this stuff. And actually, that's kind of freeing. Like, So,
yeah, there's a part of me, I have traded a few things in contemporaneously, just because they've been worth a ton. So I had a copy of House of the Dead for Saturn, which I just decided, you know what? I actually had two copies. I was really lucky, because there was a time at Sega where they were like, this is all stuff we're not going to move from one warehouse to the other, so go ahead and grab what you want. And Chris, myself, and some other people got like brand new Dreamcasts and had access to Saturn stuff, and one of those things was House of the Dead. And I did have it in my library for the longest time, but I did trade it in because I got $1,000 store credit at my favorite retro shop for it. And not a bad deal.
$1,000?
In store credit, yes.
But still.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Damn. All right.
Yep. And it still hasn't sold, which is interesting, because they have it in the store for like $1,200, and it's in behind a case and everything. But it's kind of nice to know that if it is picked up sometime at that price, it's going to be from someone who really knows what they have. You know what I mean? And will really value it. But I kind of a funny thing, too. I was talking to my current boss and mentioned some of these prices, and he was like, oh, man, I got some old games. I should definitely try to go to a store and sell them. And they're really popular ones, too. And I'm like, what do you have? He's like, oh, man, like Madden 95. And and I said, no. You have to have nerd tastes. If you like nerdy stuff, it'll be worth something.
Sports games, not worth anything after the initial year. Yeah.
Yeah. So, hey, I wanted to wrap up with just talking a little bit about peripherals, because I will say, first of all, cases. I know we've each gotten some cases for the Switch 2. Mine's a temporary case because the SF Bags, the Waterfield case, is sold out right now. But if anyone's wondering if it's worth that nearly $200 price tag, it is, because I got the first one. CJ, I know you got one too. And the way I put it is if Indiana Jones ran around with a Switch, he'd be carrying this, right? It I looks agree. Cool. My kids still think it's a purse and will tell me as much, but...
it's a man bag.
Yeah. I will instead call it the action satchel, which they're not convinced by. But it's so beautiful, and it just holds up. It is as perfect now as it was when I bought it 8 years ago, so I have to get one of those. What are you guys doing for carrying this thing around?
Well, I'm using the official Nintendo case is what I bought, and it's nice. It's very thin, which is great. Like I feel like a lot of Switch 1 cases, some of which I own, have space for like other things and are like bulky. Like they have space for game cards and also AC adapters and things that I don't really need. So like I appreciate the thinness of these official Switch 2 cases. A lot thinner than my Steam Deck case, that's for sure. And it's nice. It fits fine. If I ever get like additional Joy-Con 2, like if Hori makes a SplitPad Pro, I'll have to get a different case. But otherwise, yeah. I like the official Nintendo one. I didn't put the screen protector on because I'm not a fan of those. But
nope, me neither.
I am using...
It comes with one also.
It comes with one, and I threw it right in the garbage.
No, sorry. The Switch 2 has a screen protector on it already.
Oh, right. The film. Yes, you're right.
The film. Yeah. So I feel properly protected.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, Chris, you're just using the standard Nintendo one as well?
No, I've ordered TomTalk. They make a slim profile one as well that looks pretty nice. I've got the matcha green coming, I think, this week. So nice. Pretty excited about nice. That.
I've heard great things about that case, too.
I have as well. I just went on the Reddits, of course, and the people seem to be pretty effusive about them. So we'll see what it's like. But like you, CJ, I prioritize kind of having a slim profile because I just want something that I can – hold my Switch and then throw that into my backpack or something, and that seems like the perfect solution for that.
Yeah.
Well, and then.
But the water field does look beautiful. I'm not going to lie; they look pretty nice.
Yeah, and like anything else for the Switch too, it's an 8-year purchase, right? It'll last for a long, long time. So, the other thing that I'm not as hot on is the camera, which I bought the camera, thought that I wouldn't be able to get it. It sounded like it would be pretty rare. Now it's easy to find anywhere, but I hate how it sets itself up. I don't like that you just put it into the top of the Switch as a USB dock. I hoped that it would be something you'd put into the dock itself. Mm-hmm. And I haven't used it yet. There's been no friends of mine that are eager or interested at all in being on camera. So I wanted to try it at least as a novelty. But have either of you purchased it or used it?
I did not purchase it. Well, I tried to at Target. We know how that went. Nobody came to help me, so I didn't buy it.
Yeah, I haven't bought it either. It's not to say I won't, but I guess I need to figure out what the use case is for it. I haven't played online with mini buds yet, so I might check it out.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll report back later on that, but I just... I'm surprised that for being a feature that they made such a big deal about with Paul Rudd talking about playing it with his family and all that, like I just couldn't, after trying, find people to play with
Ethan,
that
thing. You think Paul Rudd might have been paid to say that? This is not his actual Maybe. Experience. But I'm curious about it, too. Like, Welcome Tour has a camera section that I can't play without the camera. So
yeah.
You have the standard Nintendo one, or do you have the Piranha Plant?
No, I have the standard Nintendo one.
Okay. Yeah.
So we'll have to see.
The Piranha Plant one's pretty cute.
It is pretty cute.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would ever use it. I tried to use Game Chat the other day. I sent a Game Chat request to my buddy Phil Theobald, P1 podcast co-host, and he didn't pick up. He didn't pick up. A single tear rolled down my cheek.
Yeah.
Now, you remember that, CJ, when I try to ping you and you want to ignore me.
You can ping me. You can do it. I'm there.
Okay.
Send me a chat request. I'll pick up.
We have the technology.
Well,
I'm curious to see how well it works, because on Welcome Tour... I don't know if either of you picked up Welcome Tour, but there's like a section mm-hmm. about the microphone, and so it lets you record a little test. So I did so with the Switch in the dock and me on the couch, and it sounded like I was in a huge cave just a little like really oh, echo, man. A little echoey, but it would probably pass in a pinch.
But not state of the art.
No, no. It reminded me a little bit of the WeSpeak days. Do you remember the WeSpeak?
Oh yeah.
Microphone that they heavily promoted with Animal Crossing City Folk and Monster Hunter 3 on Wii, and yeah, that thing wasn't that good either. And this,
yeah,
this I don't know is great either, but I'd like to try it.
Well, it's at least gotten better than the Dreamcast era, where remember the C-Man microphone that also you could use with the Alien Tank game, and that Alien Tank game. I let my friend play it. I walked out of the room for 10 minutes. I came back, and I got banned from the game in that 10 minutes based on what he did with the microphone. So, yeah. But, yeah, so the other thing to look at is just with launch overall, I was talking to my son and was saying, like, how do you feel about what's come out? Because, again, he's super excited about Mario Kart, but he doesn't want to play the other stuff, as I mentioned. And I asked him, like, okay, well, compared to Dreamcast launch, which, fair enough, he wasn't born yet, but he, like, is kind of a games historian, so he knows what came out, and he knows how many great games came out then. I said, what would you prefer, to be in a position where everything great came out on the Switch 2 day one, and then you had a drought for several months, which, remember, that's what we got on Dreamcast. Like, they had this awesome lineup, but then, like, no games for 3 months. Or would you rather it be parceled out? Because now we have Donkey Kong to look forward to, Mario Party, there's the Metroid Prime 4, and Pokemon. So we know we have, like, every month until the end of the year, something that's first party that's interesting. What would you, his take was that he would rather just have it all. He wants it Christmas Day.
Of course he does.
Yeah. What do you two think? Would you rather have Donkey Kong still to look forward to, or Metroid Prime 4? Or would you have liked to have it all at once? Dreamcast style.
I am a parcel it out month by month type of player. I think I fall into, well, with the Dreamcast launch, I bought a bunch of games and then only played a handful, small handful. And now I try to be a little bit better about that, but I still did it with Switch 2. I'm not really putting much time into Ridge Racer or Fast Fusion. I prefer the parceling it out.
The drip.
Yeah. And Switch 1 did that too. And I thought,
yep.
In the middle of it, it feels like, oh, I have to wait for all these great games. But when you look back on it, you're like, man, wasn't year one of Switch 1 great?
Yep. Now, I will say that Mario Kart isn't Zelda and
no.
Donkey Kong isn't Mario Odyssey. But that being said. But
Donkey Kong looks pretty cool, though.
It does. It does.
Yeah, they definitely have Mario'd it up in terms of the offering and what you can do in it.
It's yep.
got some pretty cool mechanics.
What about you, Chris?
But I also, I'm on the drip as well. I have so much great content to catch up with anyway. So again, there's not enough hours in the day to get through it anyway. So I'm totally happy with the launch, and there's plenty of great games to tuck into. So. No complaints on my end.
Yep. Well, CJ, thank you so much for joining us this week. You were one of the top people I wanted on the show for this specific conversation because we did it before 8 years ago, and it's really fun to revisit that. So thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, anytime. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, great to meet you. Thanks for joining again. And everyone, thanks for listening.
And you can reach out to us and let us know your thoughts at Chris. We have an email address now.
We do. It's info@gamesasapodcast.com.
Yeah. So please let us know what you're playing, what you're looking most forward to next, and we'll talk to you all next week.